Welcome to The Vinyl Preacher, your weekly podcast where we talk about the Bible and make a playlist. I'm Matt Cale, pastor at St. Mark's Lutheran Church, Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Zach Ferris. I'm the pastor of a community called Bread and Belonging, supported by Lutheran Campus Ministry and St. Aidan's Episcopal Church at the University of Colorado, here in Boulder, Colorado.
Well, what's going on in the world, Zach? It's mid-November.
It's mid-November, and that means only one thing in my household, Matt. It's time to go back into quarantine. One of the members of my household recently tested positive for COVID. They were unvaccinated. I tried to reach them for comment. They said they'd done their own research, that they'd done some homeopathic treatments. Nevertheless, somehow they are the ones who got the COVID. It may also have been that they had not legally been able to be vaccinated, and we missed that window by about 3 days. So real close to making it through the pandemic. And just a reminder, Matt, no matter how normal things seem, things aren't particularly normal here in Colorado. We're at a crazy high. Things are not good right now in Colorado. But it is a case, I think, of that, like, two different realities where, like, hospitals are full, rates are quite high, but that's almost exclusively among the unvaccinated. Mm-hmm. So great time for you to come on out, Matt. Hope you got your homeopathic therapies here in time to immunize yourself.
Yeah, I did think, oh my gosh, maybe I should get that booster before I go. I hadn't even really been thinking. I was like, is that really a thing? Isn't it? And then they had some article in LA Times today that was like, yeah, definitely got to get that booster. People aren't getting their booster shots. I'm like, oh no, maybe I should get on that.
I got my booster scheduled, Matt. I got it scheduled for after the concert. I responded, like many people in our demographic, quite poorly to the second dose. And my friend, who's a nurse down the street, got her booster a little while back and said she had a similar experience with the booster. I also, despite what some people in my household say, some people in my house, when I get a flu shot, typically I find that I get sick. And some people in my house tell me I'm making it up and that I'm not sick and they need to get over that. They're not super sympathetic. So I've scheduled them for the same day, same arm. I just decided, Matt, to go same hole, right? Like,
yeah.
They're like, you want to spread it out so you don't have like a doubly sore arm. While you're making holes in my body, let's just put a couple different things in there. So like extra big, like not the syringe part, but the pushy part, a double size one of those. Boom, boom. One hole in and out.
Definitely. I mean, if this is the new pandemic reality, we might as well just get a little port. Stand right there, ready to go.
Ports. My daughter would appreciate the port. She had been so excited, not really excited about getting the vaccine, but what that would mean. And now that we actually have a date scheduled for her to get the vaccine, not actually super excited about it.
Yeah, it is strange times. As my wife said, everyone she knows is exposed or quarantined, or
all four
of the people that she knows are affected this week. Yeah, our kids were exposed. Well, one of them was exposed, and then I guess they decided, let's just send the other kid home too, which is great. Great for us. So, yeah, like, seemed to be fine, but continues to flip your week upside down.
Week. Oh, 10 days, Matt.
2 weeks, 3 weeks.
10 days with your positive test, and then we had classroom exposure, which is where she likely got it, which meant we were home before the positive test actually came in, and then the 10-day clock started. So just a helpful reminder that things are not at all normal and that suddenly you can lose 2 weeks. That sounds super, like, focused, like, capitalistic, doesn't it? Lose 2 weeks of, like, work or life or whatever. We suffer the terrible fate, Matt, of having to spend time together for 2 weeks.
I know. It is super strange. I mean, I'll say, from a ministry perspective, we've been doing outdoor worship. It's been surprisingly great. And now people have started asking, hey, the weather's getting cold. When are we going to move inside? And just, you know, for relative terms, I know you live in Colorado. Weather getting cold here is 60s. If it's below 70 degrees,
it's chilly.
Below 70 degrees, get inside. It's not safe to be outdoors.
Hey, it's 73 right now.
It's pretty. Getting a little chilly, a little light jacket, but you should be okay. I honestly, we could just stay outside for a while, but what's the tipping point? What's the, like, I don't know. I mean, probably the kids are inside during school, so it's for an hour on a Sunday, it's probably fine. But I don't know. It's a very strange time. It's a super weird time. The Atlantic even published an article written by a pastor saying my church doesn't know what to do anymore. And I was like, wow, The Atlantic picking this up. So it's definitely it's super weird. It's been a weird 2 years, but this is another phase of weirdness. A distinct and unique phase.
I have a feeling, Matt. I have a feeling the difficulty in interpreting the signs of the times may come up later in the episode. I should say every member of my family is perfectly healthy. I mean, not perfectly, I guess, because we're quarantined and unable to leave the house. But in terms of having the COVID, there was just a short temperature for a minute. And for better and worse, we're up at 100 miles an hour, full speed, for the rest of this 10-day lockdown.
Thanks for clarifying that, because as I mentioned, one time Bishop Eaton talked about my family and did not clarify that my daughter was okay and everyone was worried. So thank you for the clarification. It's really important.
Everybody's fine. Everybody's fine. I mean, you know, nobody's fine. But also, for us, at least, everybody's fine. Yeah, Matt, crazy 2 years. A thing you're preparing to travel to Colorado this week, next week, for the Vinyl Preacher's first ever official concert with Clem Snide. Gonna be great. Already sold out.
The Vinyl Preacher presents.
The Vinyl Preacher presents. Also, my mother-in-law is coming out, and my mother-in-law is beloved by my child. She's so excited that her boo is coming out. It's been talking about it nonstop. We have a countdown for about 20 days. We're well into the single digits. We're under a week now. But we'd also done some math. It's crazy. So, you know, my daughter's five, almost and a half. She's five and a half now. She is five and a half in kindergarten. And she was three the last time, like, her grandparents came out, which is crazy, right? Like, that's like, it's 2 years, which you're like, yep, it's been 2 years. But then, like, she was quasi potty trained maybe at the time. Like, and now she's doing, like, she can write and kind of read and, like, she literally can't remember, right, like, the last time her grandparents came out.
It is.
I'm sure, Matt, that the organizers of the Vinyl Preacher Presents Clem Snide in-home show will make excellent choices concerning public health and safety of Israel.
Good.
They'll consult.
What are the policies in place?
Oh, yeah, there are policies and procedures. I want everybody to be very aware. You got to bring your card, Matt. Don't forget to bring your vax card to get in the door.
I got it in my Apple wallet.
And don't try to... can you get one your Apple wallet?
I live in California.
Really? Dang it. I gotta figure that out. I just have the uncomfortably large piece of cardboard.
You don't have a digital one? Come on, Colorado.
I don't know. Maybe that's the problem we're having.
That's why I voted for Gavin. Just for my digital vaccination card.
Smart. Smart. We did have some results come in here in Colorado. I am sure, Matt, that you listened to a previous episode here where I talked to Peter Severson from Lutheran Advocacy Ministry Colorado.
Surprise episode come out. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure you got into it. We spent 75 minutes getting into the three statewide ballot initiatives here. And good news for Peter, for Lutherans, and for the gospel. All three were defeated, which was what they wanted. So.
Good. What were they?
Actually, not that great. They deserved to be defeated. There was one. The first one that I can think of was an initiative that would create, that would remove... essentially take away the governor's power to spend federal funds, kind of a response to, like, what some people might see as excesses, abuses of power of the executive branch during, like, getting COVID aid packages and stuff, and just the governor being able to decide what happens to it. According to our friend Peter, it would have completely reorganized the way government works in the state of Colorado, because every federal dollar would have required, like, our very part-time, they're only in session like 4 months a year, legislatures to approve everything, like, all the time. And so, so most Republicans did not want that to pass either, and it did not. Then there was a let's tax marijuana and create a school tutoring program, I believe it was. And what it was an effort to create an educational system outside of the Department of Education that whose curriculum would be determined by politically appointed leaders. That one was also defeated.
Good.
And then the other one was to cut property tax, Matt, which sounds good. Residential property tax, which again sounds good in a state like us, but it was limited to multifamily dwellings. So it was a tax cut for landlords and slumlords and stuff. The people who are really hurting, yeah. Matt, who own lots of property.
Yeah. People didn't vote for that.
The idea was that they would that they'd pass the savings along to renters.
Okay.
Which is so they decided to do this instead of like passing a or proposing an amendment that would directly benefit renters. You know, landlords, they always like to pass on the saved buck to the tenants.
It's true.
All defeated. At Peter's suggestion. I have to think that our episode of podcast did it.
That's right. Good job. Way to influence. Way to use your influence for good.
I did talk to Peter a little bit. I don't know if you know this. Peter Severson, local Lutheran legend, director of Lutheran Advocacy Ministry, Colorado, was a contestant on Jeopardy. It was a high school contestant on Jeopardy. So I let him off the bat with surprised him with who should be the next host of Jeopardy in these partisan difficult times. And this was a couple weeks ago, and I've got some new thoughts, Matt, that I'd like to share with our listeners. And that's that I'm not sure that Aaron Rodgers should be the host anymore.
You don't think so?
I mean, I don't know, right? I'm thinking he may not be the perfect.
He'd probably want to do his own research on the answers to every question. So that's, you know.
That's true.
He can do his own research.
Shailene Woodley would be right there with him.
Oh. We should have had Adam on to defend his Green Bay Packer quarterback.
Gosh, he has been so fervent in his defense of Aaron Rodgers in our private conversations, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Oh. Slander.
Yeah. What a time to be alive.
What a time to be alive, man.
Well, we've got 2 weeks left in this lectionary year.
Only one more ordinary text week. Next week, you're looking at Christ the King Ranch Sunday. This is your last ordinary Sunday.
I know. Well, let's see what we've got. First Samuel. Why are we in First Samuel? I guess we went through what? We went through Job, and then I don't even remember. Ruth. We were in Ruth first.
We detoured
through Ruth.
We did Samuel already. I am a little confused.
We're going back. Oh,
like I so feel like we're scraping because we did Witch of Endor, right? Like we did Ghost of Samuel.
That's true, we did.
Great. Like he's already died.
We did.
And now they're like, hey, were you wondering where that guy who died came from?
Oh my goodness. Well, here's the story. On the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to his wife. This is an interesting place to start. Why did they start with verse 4? On the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to his wife Peninnah and to all her sons and daughters, but to Hannah he gave a double portion because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. Her rival used to provoke her severely to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. So it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore Hannah wept and would not eat. And her husband Elkanah said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? Why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons? After they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose and presented herself before the Lord. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord, wept bitterly. She made this vow, O Lord of hosts, if only we'll look on the misery of your servant and remember me, and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a male child, Then I will set him before you as a Nazarite until the day of his death. He shall neither drink wine nor intoxicants, and no razor shall touch his head. As she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was praying silently, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought she was drunk. So Eli said to her, "How long will you make a drunken spectacle of yourself? Put away your wine." But Hannah answered, "No, my lord, I am a woman deeply troubled. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman, for I have been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation all this time." Then Eli answered, "Go in peace. The God of Israel grant the petition you have made to him." She said, "Let your servant find favor in your sight." And the woman went to her quarters and ate and drank with her husband, and her countenance was sad no longer. They rose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord, and they went back to their house at Ramah. Elkanah knew his wife Hannah, and the Lord remembered her. In due time, Hannah conceived and bore a son. She named him Samuel, for she said, "I have asked him of the Lord." Word of God, word of life.
Thanks be to God. Here, Matt, point of clarification, because it's not super clear. I had to just now, as you read it, look up the Wikipedia article, because I was confused after the first paragraph as to the relationship between Elkanah and Hannah. Elkanah has two wives.
Yep.
First sentence, a little confusing.
Yeah.
He would give portions to his wife, Peninnah, and to all of her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he gave a double portion. Makes it sound like a child to me, but, you know, I don't have polygamistic ears from the ancient Near East.
Yeah, it's weird. They clarify that in verses 1 to 3. Let's assume, I don't. I mean, I feel like this is the. Why do they start with verse 4? I don't get it.
I don't. I mean, so the first couple verses here, Matt, are pretty like straight. What's the word I'm looking for? Genealogy. There we go. Yeah, no, it does not explain that Hannah is. Oh yeah, it does. It does. He had two wives. Verse 2. Name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other was Peninnah.
Yeah, that's a good. I mean, I guess I'm struck by that, as you pointed out, like just these rivalries, like these continue in the Old Testament in so many different ways, and in the New Testament too. But it's rivalries, right? Like they're everywhere. It's a key thread.
It is a key thread, Matt, and I think it's worth noting here on the Two White Guys Preacher podcast. I am struck because, at your recommendation, Matt, I am deep into season 3 of What We Do in the Shadows, and there's an episode upcoming in which the main characters of What We Do in the Shadows are four vampires, three of whom are male and one is female, and Nandor, one of the male vampires, has a romantic interest. And throughout this episode, it's a running bit that the men are like, "Oh, Nadia does not like Julia. We know that you two can't get along, right?" And she's like, "I don't dislike her just because we're women." And they're like, "Meow," right? Like the whole like setting up this like female rivalry. And so like when you hear this story, I think it is important to hear it. The barren woman story, to some of us with some biblical literacy, you're going to hear it as a contrast to the Sarah Abraham story, as something to compare it to. But it's also important to hear it as a trope throughout the Bible, and especially throughout the Torah, that it happens with Sarah, and that what these result in are these rivalries among women. Mm. And so, important to note, the women did not write these stories, and men writing women is a interesting thing to look up on Twitter, and you can find lots of funny stuff about that. But they end up in these rivalry things. The little bit of salt, sprinkle a little bit of salt on it, because we have Sarah, and you end up in this unhealthy rivalry with Hagar. But then I didn't really know this. Rebecca was barren, but Isaac prays, and then she has twins. Rachel is barren, and this is set within the rivalry between Rachel and Leah. And they go back and forth and having like a child off, because Leah then becomes barren, but Rachel had got a concubine to bear children for her, and so Leah goes to get a concubine to bear children for her, and then miraculously, Rachel has her own child, which turns out to be Joseph. And so I read like in some commentary stuff that you could contrast this with Sarah and I guess Rachel going to not trusting the promise and going to find a concubine to have a child for them, that you could see here the good news in this in terms of like not having a victim and not leaving Hagar and her own child to die in the desert alone, sort of a thing. And this is like the good news version. But as you lift up, Matt, they're like, you've got the female rivalry thing here as well.
Yeah, that's a good contextual point. Thanks for that. There's that trope, and then there's this. I mean, the word they use is barrenness, right? This person that wants a child and can't seem to bear a child. This too seems like a running trope, and one that's kind of challenging to know what to do with.
Yeah. Fortunately, it has very little to do with people these days' real lives, are not emotionally connected to these issues.
Yeah. I mean, it continues to be a live thing in people's lives. So to read a story like this, I mean, yeah, you've got to, it's a great, I mean, like, it's a good story as story, but can also have some razor sharp edges, and so you want to treat it with care.
I'm interested here, Matt. I just am doing research on the fly. That's the kind of episode this is. About the etymological connection between the English words for bear, as in to like bear fruit, and bear as in B-A-R-E, barrenness. I don't know what those are. My immediate here, etymonline.com did not give me an immediate answer, but could be a interesting preaching tool to get into it and playing those words against each other.
Yeah. So we just, in my extra lectionary series, we've been using Sanctified Art, as I've talked about before, and they just had this text a few weeks ago. And the take that we had on it kind of zeroed in around this middle part where Hannah says, Hannah kind of, you know, Eli challenges her and is like, what are you doing? He misjudges her. And then she opens her mouth and out spills this. I mean, she just bares her soul to him and tells him what's going on. And then his response is like, to put it, like, if we're going to read it charitably, it might just be go away, because this is a little overwhelming. Mm-hmm. But to read it charitably, it's like he sees her, he recognizes, changes his tune, and it's an I see you kind of moment. And at that moment, she goes back home, and her countenance is sad no longer. She does not at that point, that's where the reading ends in that particular thing. It just ends there, right? Like that she doesn't have a child yet. That the issue that has been so painful for her has not been like fixed or solved or changed in any way, but she has been seen. She has been seen. And her countenance is sad no longer. And just that moment of being seen seems to be a really clear turning point. And then of course she does go, like the story continues and she bears a son. But I think it's interesting that like her countenance is sad no longer, it happens before she bears a son. It happens at the moment that she's seen.
I can't let it pass, Matt. You said that she bears her soul to Eli.
Yeah.
Right? And I wonder actually, right, if that might be a helpful like way to think about the story, in that it is her countenance is sad no longer before she has the child, but when she has like released the stuff she's carrying, when she has bared her soul and is truly empty. So if you're looking for that cruciform shape, there's some of that there. I think it's interesting that the story begins and ends in the same place. She has no child at the beginning of the story, and then at the end she gives her child to Eli and has no child again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that the barrenness is not, she returns to the barrenness. It's different, right? Like the barrenness can be redeemed, but it doesn't go away.
Yeah. Well, let's move to this gospel text, Mark 13.
Mark 13, the lucky chapter of Mark. We're running out of chapters here, Matt. Things are getting intense. Jesus has just been watching people put leptas into the treasury at the temple. And as he comes out, one of his disciples said to him, and I can only imagine, literally, because I wasn't there, what the tone in the disciple's voice, who says, look, teacher, what large stones, what large buildings. In my mind, Matt, I can't help but go back to the life of Brian, where I imagine the disciples been on this whole, like, with Jesus, like, yeah, the authorities in Jerusalem, the rich people, we're going to go, like, we're going to get, they're terrible. And then he gets there. This is nice. Have you seen? They have indoor plumbing. This is a big building, right? Like, this is pretty good. And then Jesus asked him, then Jesus asked him, do you see these great buildings? Which seems redundant. He just said, look at all these buildings. Not one stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down. And when he was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, I've been on the Mount of Olives, had a lovely dinner at the Lutheran World Federation guest house there, opposite the temple, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately, tell us, when will this be? And what will be the sign that all these things are about to be accomplished? And Jesus began to say to them, beware that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name and say, I am he. And they will lead many astray. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is still to come. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. But this is the beginning of the birth pangs. Boom. The gospel of the Lord, man.
Praise to you, O Christ. So as we do every year, as we move toward the warm holiday season, Thanksgiving, pumpkin spice lattes, we get these nice comforting words from Jesus.
I think this is International Canticle of the Turning Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Time to bring out Canticle of the Turning. Not a stone will be left on stone.
So, not a lot of narrative here, unless you're going to really get into the gobsmacked disciple angle that I laid out. But obviously, the super like cruciform thing, the super intensity. This story is coming on the heels of, if you're looking for some connection here, because it gets kind of quoted there as well. At the beginning of chapter 12, Jesus tells the parable about the vineyard owner. That is a super militaristic parable about the vineyard owner who builds the vineyard and builds watchtowers and fences, and then comes to take it back, and the son is killed and there's violence and stuff. And at the end of it, you know, I think Jesus says, not one stone will be left upon another. So that intensity is increasing. Where it ends up, I think it was Satterley who said, you know, people really like to sing Canticle of the Turning, but then they never tear down their church building. Right at the end of it, like, if you have pickaxes and stuff, and so at the end of that last stanza of Canticle of the Turning, you start taking them to your church walls. That's what, like, the Canticle of the Turning is really about, is tearing down your structures of power and authority. Mm-hmm. And that we're pretty hesitant to do that. Mm-hmm. to our own buildings.
Yeah, I mean, I guess as I'm seeing it now and drawing that connection to Canticle of the Turning. And of course, Canticle of the Turning is like really inspired by the Magnificat, and they kind of borrowed this line from Mark 13 with the stone left on stone. But that makes me think, though, that, like, you know, in some ways, like, obviously, like, Mark, the Magnificat's in Luke, but still this sense that, like, yeah, what if this does echo... Jesus is echoing what his mother taught him. And to take that in zoom the lens back a little bit, this is a tradition that goes back before Jesus. It's not like Jesus is showing up out of nowhere and, like, bringing some apocalyptic imagery. But in fact, he's drawing on, like, a really long tradition that goes back through Daniel and through a lot of the apocalyptic texts of the Hebrew scriptures. And so it's just that thread begins before this moment. And then we'll continue, right? Like, it's interesting that, like, you know, we get these apocalyptic texts. And then, of course, the apocalyptic texts, they always surprise me that we get them at the beginning of Advent. And so, like, this is, it's like those albums where they come full circle, where, like, if you listen to Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, it kind of ends with the same sounds that it begins with. So you could just listen to it on repeat, and it sounds like one complete whole. And I wonder what that means, that the hinge of this, the hinge of it is taking a pickaxe to your church building.
I love that, Matt, that he's just saying what his mama taught him. That's good. That's real good. Because, right, beginning of Luke has another, the tradition of the barren Hebrew woman continues, mm-hmm. right, in Elizabeth, mm-hmm. who miraculously has a child. Mm-hmm. And that there's completion here as well, right? That Mary loses the son. You know, Jesus has renounced his family already here. And yet the important inheritance, the gospel inheritance continues despite those renunciations. I think that, you know, most church people, I think, would be willing to take pickaxes to their own walls if we had clear instructions, right? If Jesus was coming again and, like, the instructions were, you got to, like, tear every stone from stone because we're going to build this new building here that's going to be fantastic and do all these things, right? And that was the promise. Like, sure, let's take it apart. But it is like birth pangs in the sense of, like, the second half of what this reading gets at is that deep, like, desire for clarity and certainty of what to do. What to do in the midst of, like, of the thing of the chaos of the rebel, right? And Jesus doesn't really give us too much clarity there, in terms of interpreting, you know, the signs of the times.
I want to put that Prince song on there. Sign of the times fit in too. I guess I also like, if I'm preaching this text in a community, especially at this time, like, I mean, this is just the reality of the world too, right? He's not speaking about something that's, like, hard to imagine. Like, yeah, this is, yeah. Like, we live in this topsy-turvy world and people do feel fear around it. It makes me think, I mean, this is it's a weakness I have reading the news this week, reading the political news coming out of the front page of the New York Times this week, elections and what's the mood of the country. You think a year ago we were, it was the 2020 election. Can you believe that was 1 year ago that it was the week of the 2020 elections?
It's 5 years
ago. Everybody's posting their memes of Endgame and Thanos is going to be defeated and, oh, this is great. You know, we're ushering in a new administration. It's good. Like, I think that was probably a step in the right direction rather than the wrong direction. And then you find yourself a year later, and it seems like, all right, the mood of the country is changed again. I'm not sure what's going on. Can't seem to get a bill passed. And kind of like the whole thing, if you tie your well-being to things always feeling good or things always seeming like they're being built in some kind of, like, straightforward, clear instructions kind of way, like, you're going to be standing on topsy-turvy ground. And so I wonder, like, you see the ups and downs. You see the legitimate... you live in the midst of a time where, is COVID over? Is it not over? Is there a new variant on the rise? Am I supposed to get a booster shot? Like, we live in a world of much confusion. And so I wonder, like, what Jesus is saying, both in terms of, like, comfort in the midst of that, if that is indeed a thing, or even just, like, something to hold on to in the midst of that. Like, stay focused on this. You're going to hear, like, you just kind of just mm-hmm. big picture, broad strokes of what he's saying. It's like, this stuff is all going to be going on, but focus on this. Like, keep your eyes on the prize, for lack of a, like, to use the classic line, but keep your eyes on what exactly? But, like, focus on all this stuff is going to be happening. Like, it's all going to be happening, but I want you to keep your eyes here.
The reading's a bit negative for me. You know, I think it'd be a little more helpful if there's a little more positive. not in terms of mood, but like what to do, you know? And you're getting at that, right, Matt? And where I might go in writing a sermon this week is back to the Magnificat, because that does give you, I think, some really, some clearer, I mean, I think that's the thread, right, that I would go to, that, you know, the right answer on a test is the gospel, and then I would go to the Magnificat here, even though I know you're jumping, you're crossing the streams of the gospels like you're not supposed to.
Yeah, no, I think that's the place to go.
And that chaos and uncertainty of what to do and why things are happening, easy to read in the newspaper, if you can go find a newspaper somewhere. But then in the deeply personal, like in the somewhat deeply personal in the Old Testament reading, right, that like that folks struggling with infertility, typically that's a super personal thing, you know, that isn't borne by a community that you can... These texts reach that far.
Yeah, and even you know, nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, person against person. I mean, the much smaller scale battles over kingdoms, the much smaller scale earthquakes in our own lives, the famines that we experience closer to home. These are real things too. And you gotta, I just feel like if you're preaching, you've got to get there at some point, even if you draw it back out to the big picture too.
The other tension that I might lift up that I thought about with these texts are the tension and actually the similarities between the barrenness. Like, on one hand, you have barrenness and what that reality is. And on the other hand, you have way too much going on. You've got the chaos of the world. And neither one is actually, like, we might pray for the other while in the other spot, but that neither path is our particular, like, salvation, that as, you know, to do it in a liminal postmodern way, as our path winds through barrenness and overabundance, it's not... Neither one of those homes is the home that will ultimately hold us.
Amen. Well, what are we listening to as we prepare to preach on these texts?
Oh, Matt, I got a good one. I got a real good one. Matt, you're coming out for The Vinyl Preacher Presents Clem Snide at Home, our first in our concert series. And you're coming to that show because Phoebe Bridgers decided to decline my invitation. So we got Clem Snide. I have no problem telling Eve that he was our backup plan. But that said, on her tour called the Reunion Tour this fall, Phoebe Bridgers has been playing the same encore and closing the shows with That Funny Feeling, which is actually a Bo Burnham song. Do you Bo Burnham? No. I know some people are super into Bo Burnham. I don't either. I have not. He's a comedian, I guess. I know he's a comedian. And he's got a Netflix special or whatever called Inside. And evidently it has songs. I'm going to watch the special now because Phoebe has covered this song and just released it as a single. And she does it better than him. Surprise. But it's really good. And it's a song about the end of the world. who I'm going to give you a couple snippets because the verses are very clever and funny. Stunning 8K resolution meditation app in honor of the revolution. It's half off at the Gap. And then the chorus is, there it is again, that funny feeling. Gosh, what was the other one that I really liked? The Surgeon General's pop-up shop, Robert Iger's face, discount Etsy, Agripop, Bugles take on race. As in the chip company. And then the outro is killer. Hey, what can you say? We were overdue, but it'll be over soon. After 20,000 years, only 7 more to go. So Phoebe Bridgers, That Funny Feeling, covering Bo Burnham. Put it on the playlist for your, hey, everything's burning down around us. What do? You sing this song. Then, Matt, we mentioned it last week, Jesus is dropping bombs, and so are the Gap Band, perhaps their most well-known song, You Dropped a Bomb on Me. nugget I learned on the NPR this week, who Gap Band, having a moment, though there's only one surviving member. Gap Band, G-A-P, stands for Greenwood, Archer, and Pine, which are streets in the Greenwood neighborhood where the Tulsa Race Massacre occurred, featured in a lot of pop culture stuff the past couple years with, like, The Watchmen and Lovecraft Country.
Did not know that. I didn't know that was where that came from.
Right? You don't think about that for a disco band? Pretty good. And then getting ready for the show this week, I'm putting a Clem Snide song on that's not off of the new album, but off of an older EP. It's called I'll Be Your Mirror, which is actually a cover of the Velvet Underground song written by Lou Reed. Oh, gosh. And I think it fits even better now that we've recorded the podcast and talked about the text. I'll be your mirror. Reflect what you are, in case you don't know. I'll be the wind, the rain, and the sunset, the light on your door to show you that you're home. Because when you think the night has seen your mind, that inside you're twisted and unkind, let me stand to show you that you are blind. Whew, Bartimaeus, please put down your hands, because I see you, Matt. Oh, it's Eli in the voice of Clem Snide.
Good stuff. I feel like I should listen to some Clem Snide before next week. I'll just be surprised. I'll hear all these songs for the first time. It'll be great.
It'll be great. It'll be great.
Well, we have not hosted any backyard concerts at our apartment complex, but we did host some music at our church last week. We had some local musicians as part of an community organizing conference. And the lead musician was Isaiah Taimani, who is actually on Spotify. He's got a whole album out, Isaiah Taimani and Minor Islands, and he covered this gospel spiritual Building Me a Home, which has been in my head ever since. It's really good. And as I think about tearing things down and what we're going to build in its place, we'll put that in there, Building Me a Home.
Noise.
Thought about, I just put in the word war into Spotify, and then I was like, oh yeah, there's that band, The War on Drugs. I saw them at Coachella one time. They're really good. And they have a new single out, so let's just put that in there. I don't live here anymore. And then also, speaking of new singles, you too. New single out.
Oh yeah? New stuff?
Yeah, I put it on to audition it for my children, and Maya said, it sounds like a prince is singing. Which I'll take it. Then I realized that was just her way of saying that it sounds like a male of the species. Was it just any male at all would be sick. We're just gonna call him Prince. So fine.
I mean, technically, that is Bono.
So the Irish Times had a review of the single, of which they said it was their pipe and slippers phase of U2's career. Which, yeah, all right. I'll take it.
It sounds lovely.
I'll take it.
I can't wait for the pipe and slippers phase of my life.
I'll take it. So the song is your song. It saved my life.
My song?
That's, oh. Yeah. That's what I got.
Like it. Got. Looking forward to some listening this week. Do you know who else is on Spotify, man? The Vinyl Preacher Podcast. You can listen to episodes on Spotify and listen to the playlist, which currently is up to date. So there you go. Lots of cool people on the Spotify.
Fantastic. Well, it's been real
vinyl.